The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Retirement Plan by Chris Steele. This one's you, Grandpa. James felt the warmth bloom in his chest as his grandson held up the drawing. A lopsided house with a crooked sun, two stick figures, one with black and white hair, holding hands. It's you, Grandpa, Eli said, pointing to the tallest figure. And there's me. Pride, joy, love, the emotions swelled together, golden and full. James's hand moved to his phone before he'd consciously decided. Muscle memory. He opened the app, logged the feelings, pride, child-related, joy, familial, love, grandchild, high grade. The extraction took 30 seconds. A gentle pull, like exhaling. The emotions drained away, leaving the memory intact but hollow. You have been credited $140.37. Thank you for using Emocom. Looking back at his grandson's eager face, he felt nothing. It's very good, James said. The words were true. He could see it was good. He remembered feeling proud, but the feeling itself was gone. Eli's smile dimmed slightly. Kids could tell. They always could. Show Grandpa what else you drew, James's daughter, Sarah, said quickly. She met James's eyes across the table. That look again, the one that said, Dad, please. Her older son, Sam, was at the counter making a sandwich, earbuds in, pretending not to notice the tension. Still a habit that had to have been hard to shake, but he'd already sold it. The transaction was complete. At least tonight he could take them out to dinner. 42 years since you could sell and buy emotions. James had thought it was absurd at first, but when Sarah turned 3, the hospital bills came. Childhood leukemia. 6 months of treatment they couldn't afford. He'd sold everything they'd take. Joy from her first steps, the love from her first dada, the relief when the doctor said she was in remission. All of it converted to currency, used to pay the bills. He'd planned to stop after that. But then there was rent, student loans, Sarah's college fund, his wife's funeral, the normal endless hemorrhaging of money that comprised a life. And after a while, every time he felt something good, something sellable, he thought, this could be 3 months of retirement, 3 months closer to freedom. Thankful he still had the memories. He could see his daughter's wedding day in his mind. But the feelings that should have been there left only a gray, empty void. In the beginning, he could generate high-grade joy every week. A good sunset, a song on the radio, his wife's hand in his. The positive emotions came easily, and he sold them just as easily. But the math was cruel. The more he sold, the more he was left with only the unsellable emotions. Frustration, anxiety, grief. The low-grade despair of daily existence. It made it harder to generate more sellable ones. They just sat in him, calcifying. By his 40s, it took a month to generate sellable joy. By his 50s, 3 months. Now at 67, the positive emotions were so rare, he'd started keeping a journal to track them. March 15, brief content. Watching birds. Sold $25.17. June 2, satisfaction from fixing the sink. Sold $33.45. He had planned to retire at 55, maybe even earlier. He had joked in the beginning. His wife had called him the comedian when they first met, but now the target kept rising. But last month, finally, he'd hit it. One final sale. The bittersweet joy of Eli's school play. James had watched his grandson dressed as a tree, his goofy dance while giggling, and immediately logged it. The first sunset nearly broke him. He was on his porch drinking coffee, blends of purples and pinks, birds flying in the distance, autumn wind on his face with the crisp smell of apple cider brewing inside. Everything hit him like a fist. Wonder, peace. His hand reached for his phone. Stopped. No. He was retired. He didn't have to sell anymore. The emotion stayed. He kept prodding at them mentally, checking. Still there. An hour later, still there. They just sat there inside him. He felt nauseous. That night he couldn't sleep. The contentment from the sunset sat in his chest like a stone. He was used to anxiety before. The tomatoes were fruiting. Heavy red globes among the green. He'd been standing there, hands dirty, picking the first ripe ones and putting them in his basket. The smell of crushed leaves on his fingers, sun-warmed fruit against his palm, earth under his knees. The pain was sudden, a vise around his chest. As he fell, time slowed. His hand slipped from a ripe tomato, leaving it clinging to the bush. I needed more time. All these positive emotions finally in his mind, finally staying instead of being sold away, finally welcomed. His life flashed before him. Memories absent, the feelings he wished he had. Sarah's first word, her face, mouth open in surprise at her own sound. Sold for rent. Emily's hand on his on their wedding day. Her smile. The flowers. Sold for student loans. 42 years of moments experienced through glass. He had 1 year of real feeling. One against a lifetime. Contentment drained away. Peace evaporated. The pride from the tomatoes curled into ash. One emotion rose sharp and true and devastating, grief. But then with everything, he would have never sold it, never given rich brats the satisfaction of taking his grief. He died with his eyes open, surrounded by tomatoes in a garden he'd never taste, feeling the full weight of his wasted life. The sadness stayed with him till the end. And he was still grateful for it. Sarah found him there, called the ambulance, held his hand as they loaded him into the van. She cried, real tears, her tears. She'd never purchased emotions. She'd seen the cost. Later, cleaning out his apartment, she found his records, a spreadsheet, meticulously kept, every emotion sold, dated, categorized. 42 years of extraction, 42 years of choosing later over now. She sat on his floor, surrounded by these records of absent feeling, and understood for the first time why he'd always seemed so distant, why he couldn't quite reach her, why his hugs felt hollow. He wasn't cold, he wasn't empty, emptied by choice, by necessity, by a system that made selling yourself feel like responsibility. Her phone buzzed, a notification from her emotional banking app. Pending sales ready for confirmation. She opened it, saw her cued transaction. Eli's first steps, joy, parental, pride, developmental, $285.49. She hovered over Cancel's sale. The rent was due. Sam needed braces. Her father's funeral would cost money she didn't have. She thought about her father's face in the garden, the tomatoes, the year he'd had. She thought about 42 years of nothing. Her finger hesitated. Then she confirmed the transaction. The emotion drained away, leaving only the memories. Eli's wobbly steps. She could see them perfectly, feel nothing. Just this one. She closed the app. To Those We Never Meet by Sarah David. Standing outside in the rain, I looked at the building before me, its walls hollow and solid at the same time. The door closed against the weather and the coming storm. I wanted to turn away to say, this is not mine. I knew better. Inside, the long hall to the chamber stretched out like miles of empty highway, a highway with no exits. Slowly, deliberately, I entered the hall. He was already waiting for me. Nothing was said between us as he watched me approach the console in front of the chamber. How do I do this? I send him back to die in a war that is not his, or I leave him here, and the war comes. I used to think time travel would feel like breaking glass, sharp, violet, immediate. But the truth is quicker, more like sliding a letter you can never take back through a slot in a locked door. The chamber hums around us, its walls breathing with slow pulses of blue light. It was once a missile silo. Now it's the last hope of a collapsing century. The air tastes metallic, like the moment before lightning strikes. He stands across from me, helmet tucked under one arm, the other hand balled into a fist, not out of fear, out of the discipline of a soldier who refuses to shake. You don't have to decide yet, he says. His voice is steady, but I can hear the fractures beneath it. Yes, I answer. I do. His name is Eamon Hale, Staff Sergeant, born 2127, dead, will die, in the year 2043. A year that, for me, happened more than a lifetime ago. Time is a spiral, not a line. Eamon is the only one who seems to understand that without going mad. You said the breach in 2043 is the nexus point, he reminds me. If I go back, maybe I close it. Maybe the invasion never starts. And if you fail, you die in a trench in Belgium, in a timeline your mother wasn't even born in. He gives me a tired smile. In fairness, Belgium hasn't been safe in six timelines. I want to laugh. I can't. The truth is simple. Eamon is not supposed to exist. He's a temporal fragment, a man born in the wrong century because of one fracture in space-time three wars ago. He slipped between eras the way a ghost slips between walls. He was raised in the remains of what used to be New Boston, apprenticed into the Chrono Corps, before he was old enough to understand why we stitch time like surgeons. And he's the only one who survived the last breach. We sent eight teams back, I whisper. You're the only one who didn't vanish. His jaw tightens. Which is exactly why I should go again. No, I step closer. Eamon, if you die in that era, I lose the only soldier who understands what we're fighting. And if I stay, he murmurs, you lose everyone. The first invasion arrived like a winter storm, quiet until it wasn't. Fractures in the sky veined with light. Creatures made of bone and shadow pouring through, hunting the living as if memory itself were meat. We call them archivists. Not because of what they look like, but because of what they took. The archivists do not kill. They erase, swallowing entire bloodlines, consuming the essence of what a life was supposed to become. They feed on possibility, on futures, on the ones we never meet. I remember the first time I saw one retrieve a man's shadow from the pavement. I still hear the pop, like a knuckle cracking. I still hear the silence after. Eamon clears his throat, pulling me back. We have 2 hours before the breach widens again, he says. The room feels colder. He steps closer. Tell me what you're afraid of. I shake my head. Losing you. He exhales, a sound that cracks through his armor. You won't remember I existed if I fail, he says quietly. That's the point. The timeline will correct. You'll wake up in a world that never needed me. That's worse. I know. His hand brushes mine, hesitant, uncertain. He was never allowed attachments. Chrono Corpse trains it out of you. But trauma rewrites rules no academy can enforce. I'll come back if I can, he says. You won't. He doesn't argue. Because we've seen the recordings, corrupted static-filled reports from dying eras showing the same soldier over and over again, falling in mud, in snow, in fire, each version disappearing into the jaws of something we couldn't see. Every version is him. We don't know whether these are past attempts or future ones. Time doesn't care. The breach alarm begins a low tremor. Eamon looks up. It's time. I follow him to the platform. He lifts his helmet, hesitates, lowers it again. You told me once, he says, that every war has two fronts, the one on the battlefield and the one inside the soul. I shouldn't have said that to you. No, his voice is steady. I needed to hear it. Then he reaches into his vest and pulls out a small metal capsule. What is that? A tether spike. If I drive it into the breach core, it'll collapse. But, he pauses. But, it'll anchor whatever is closest. He meets my eyes. It might drag me with it. My chest tightens. Eamon. It's the only way to stop the archivists before they nest. He waits for me to tell him no. I wait for him to choose to stay. Neither happens. You'll forget me, he says softly. No, I won't. He smiles, small, sad, absolutely infuriating. You will, but I won't forget you. He steps onto the platform. The chamber lights surge, spinning brighter. The air ripples, and then a sound. Voice like cracking ice, slithering through the walls, whispering through the room, the seams of reality. The archivists, they feel the breach opening. Eamon shoves his helmet on. Power it up. I slam my palm onto the console. The temporal engine roars, light twisting inward, coiling like a serpent made of stars. Eamon. He looks back just once. Thank you, he says. And then he's gone. A blast of light swallows him, bending around him, the chamber shaking until the floor almost splits. For a moment, I swear I see shapes in the breach, towering silhouettes made of bone lattices and empty eyes, reaching, reaching furious at losing their prey. Then the world snaps. The breach collapses. Silence. Time resets with the subtlety of a knife sliding between ribs. The chamber flickers. Dust settles in patterns I don't remember. My badge reads a number I've never seen before. A man I don't know touches my shoulder. Commander, you all right? The diagnostics show the breach attempt failed. Failed? I echo. Yes, ma'am. Nothing was sent. The tether spike didn't activate. My stomach twists. What about the soldier? I ask. He frowns. What soldier? My mouth goes dry. I check the logs. There is no Eamon Hale in the ChronoCorp roster. No enlisted personnel born in 2127. No records, no footprints, not even a ghost trail in the probability matrix. He's gone. Not dead. Erased. A man swallowed by his own bravery before he was ever born. Except on the console, under the flickering blue lights, I find something impossible. A fingerprint. Not mine. Not recorded. Not supposed to exist. It glows faintly, just for a moment, humming like quartz infused with sunlight. A message ripples through my mind, soft as breath. I closed it. Keep going. Don't let them take the ones we never meet. I inhale sharply. Someone notices. Commander. I'm fine, I whisper, but I'm lying. Something inside me, some thread the universe failed to cut cleanly, remembers the shape of a man who shouldn't exist. Not his name, not his face, not his voice. Just the ache, the unmistakable ache of love tangled with sacrifice. The second invasion never comes, not in this timeline. The skies remain whole. The archivists never break through the seams. Billions of lives stay untouched, unwritten, tragedies never unfolding. But some nights I hear humming, faint, resonant, impossibly familiar, like quartz singing Willie Nelson in a distant canyon. And I know, without knowing how, somewhere in the spirals of time, a soldier with no history died saving a future that will never remember him. I step outside the silo, rain falling gently, soft, quiet, undisturbed. The world kept, the cost unknown. But I lift my face to the sky anyway and whisper to the dark water falling, to those we never meet, we owe everything. And though I cannot hear him somewhere across the labyrinth of time, I feel the answer. You did meet me. That's enough. She Doesn't Do Dishes by Daniel Rogers. Targan licked his plate clean, throwing it on top of a pile of dirty plates. Alora came from the kitchen and grabbed the stack. I could hardly believe my eyes. Alora doesn't do dishes. I slowly breathed in through my nose and exhaled my mouth, as Doc taught me. I couldn't allow myself to burst out in anger. The Nakwaks counted on me to signal them when Targan retired to his room. I continued to spy through the window, wondering how Targan got Alora to serve tables. He had to have some power over her, but what? She's stronger than 10 men. Targan finally left the dining room. I signaled the Nakwaks. They moved with the speed and stealth of a ninja. The guards at the front door never saw them coming. They felt a poke, pinch, a karate chop before collapsing in sleep. Drock stepped over them and led the way inside. I wanted to go with them, but Drock insisted I remain at the window until they rescued Alora. Not very heroic, but Drock didn't want to endanger a god, and he only agreed to let me join them if I do what he said. You know, they sure do boss around their gods a lot. We only had seconds to get Alora out, but 2 minutes had passed, and they haven't returned yet. Looking through the window, I saw Drock and Alora arguing. I had had enough. I crawled through the window and interrupted. I hate to interrupt this argument, but since death is on the line, why don't we postpone this until we get back to the temple? She won't leave, Drock said. I can't leave, Drew. She pointed to a small black device hanging from the necklace around her neck. I gasped. A magnetic disruptor. If activated, it would scramble Alora's circuits like eggs. It's an android killing device, which shocked me to see on a primitive planet, but even more shocking was how Targon got one. I quickly formed a plan. The disruptor controller had to be near, most likely with Targon. I needed Drock's help to retrieve it without telling them what it was. Drock, we must find a small black box about the size of a teacup, except flat. My guess is Targon has it. I won't go near Targon. Drock's old fears of his childhood bully clearly showed. I had to give him a reason to help me find it, that it was stronger than his fear. It contains Alora's power. Without it, she can't leave. Drock struggled, then ordered the Nokwaks to join him as they made their way to Targon's room. Alora and I followed. Targon's door was shut. We all looked at each other, searching for someone to tell us what to do next. Drock shrugged, went to the door and knocked. "Who's there?" a voice from inside asked. "It's Drock." Drock from school? Yes, that one. The door opened and Targon stood confused as a squirrel in traffic. His eyes widened when he saw all of us standing outside his room. What is this? Guards! Guards! They're taking a little nap, Drock said. We need the god power box. If you hand it over, we'll be on our way. Targon squared his shoulders. Make me. Drock and Targon locked eyes. The rest of us backed away to give them room. We all knew whose fight this was. The punches and blocks began like lightning. Drock backed as Targon aggressively attacked, lashing out with such ferocity that it frightened me. I can only imagine how Drock felt. Drock blocked and parried like a true master. He showed no emotion, no hint of fear or concern. Targon continued pressing until Drock used a set of countermoves that turned Targon's momentum against him. Now Drock pushed back. It dawned on me that we still needed the disruptor. I ran inside Targon's room and found it on a table near his bed. I grabbed it, hunting for the release button. I pushed it and yelled at Alora to take the device off. She did, and then things got real. Alora grabbed Targon by the back of his shirt just as Drock landed a punch in his stomach. Drock, seeing Olega... Drock, seeing Alora shake Targon senseless, ceased fighting. He obviously saw Alora had things well in hand. "So, make me wash dishes, will you?" She carried him to the kitchen and placed him in front of the sink and forced him to wash plates. Alora, I carefully said. We could all see how angry she was. As much as I love seeing him get what he deserves, we really need to get back to the temple before the entire elite guard shows up. Make me mop the floor. I didn't know androids could lose their temper, but she had definitely done so. She flipped Targon upside down and began mopping the floor with his head after having dipped him in the dishwater. "Excuse me," I said sheepishly. "Could you wrap this up soon? We really have to go." Perhaps we could come back another day and use him to dust. How does that sound? She looked at me like she had just seen me for the first time and came out of her ferocious trance. Sorry, Drew, I lost it for a little while. She dropped Targan and led the way outside. We all looked at Targan lying senseless on the wet floor, shrugged and chased after Alora. We made it to the temple without any additional incidents. Once inside, Bob and Grinfa welcomed us back. "Well, well, Alora, it's wonderful to have you back," Bob said. She nodded with a vacant expression. I believe she was still inside the house, mopping the floor with Targan. Bob had food ready for us, and we feasted, sharing war stories and laughing our heads off every time we mentioned Targan and mopping. Grinfo shouted to Drock, "Did Targan stuff you in a flower pot again?" Little brothers shouldn't poke their much bigger and stronger brothers, or they might find themselves stuffed into a flower pot. Grinfo laughed. "So is that a yes?" Drock would have kicked Targan's butt had Alora not stepped in, but I knew he wouldn't brag on himself, so I did it for him. "Grinfo, I'd be careful. Your big brother will kick your sorry butt all over this temple like he did Targan." We all laughed, except for Alora. After the party began to settle down, Alora and I took a walk. "I'm glad you're okay," I said, "and I'm sorry. It was all my fault." "Don't be ridiculous. If you'd been with me, he would have captured both of us." "Still, I can't help feeling responsible." "Well, stop it." She playfully shoved me. "Everything turned out all right." She grew thoughtful. "But I'd love to know how Targan got a hold of a disruptor." The thought had entered my mind as well. "I have no idea, but it has to have something to do with the Ladder God." "The Ladder God?" Alora shot me a look that said, "Get real." "Okay, the Telmarians. I'll introduce you tomorrow. For now, let's enjoy the evening." We walked in silence, enjoying each other's company. Maybe me more than her, but I believe she did enjoy my company a little. Dinner Party by Simone Letourneau. I looked down at my phone to see that James had texted me. "So, 7 o'clock is good?" I replied, "Yeah, that's great." To which he said, "Awesome. I'll round up the troops and bring a bottle." It was most definitely not great. Oh my gosh, are they on to me? Is that why they suggested a dinner party? What on this earth even is a dinner party? Throwing a party for dinner? I think not. Why celebrate such a taxing chore as eating? He said he'll bring a bottle. Am I supposed to bring a baby? I can't stand eating. Humans spend a lot of time on food. They eat a few meals a day on a routine schedule, carry snacks, and spend all the time either planning to cook food, cooking food, eating food, or thinking about how they should or shouldn't eat food. Where I'm from, you don't have the feeling of hunger or the need for food. On some planets, you pop a substance you guys would call a pill, and it would do its job. In some bodies, you photosynthesize, for instance. But here on this earth, you have to throw chunks of colored mush or solid or frozen, or whatever form humans choose to mutilate their nutrients into, down your esophagus. Then the job isn't complete yet. You also have to move your mass setters up and down, and sometimes side to side, and ensure you grind it down enough with these sharp white things in your pink gums, not the chewing bubble gum type. All while breathing, which of course is autonomic by now, but still also laborious. In addition, you have to learn all these little rules about eating. For example, I've learned not to chew and talk at the same time. People will think you're an animal if you do this. I've quickly learned that eating is quite separate from drinking, in the sense that you're first meant to chew the food, swallow the food, and then take a swig of a liquid. I learned this early after arriving on Earth. Humans watched me with unease as I placed meat in my mouth and followed it with water, swallowing it whole like a capsule. They found it unsettling. I found it efficient. All of that being said, I haven't even gotten to the worst part of it at all. You have to cook it first. This is something I have never done. Even though I have already taken part in an extensive list of societal norms that I've observed prior to my coming here, activities like ordering on Amazon, driving a car, and even shampooing the small colored follicles that grow from my head. I've also learned a great deal about humans from a sociological perspective. For example, they dislike change, but also dislike the mundane, and are always seeking something or consuming. Things I haven't completely understood about the quirks of humans are the English words that can be used interchangeably in multiple contexts, procreation and food, obviously. I'm not sure I'm equipped for this. Now, I've got to host these people and pretend to enjoy cooking them a meal because of one conversation we had weeks ago when we had just met. We spoke about how I cooked all my life. The entire evening, we even had inside jokes about it. It wasn't until he made a joke about cracking an egg that I realized we weren't talking about the same thing. For a moment, I considered getting carryout food, but the system seemed quite complex. I have to call, order, then carry out my food, though I've heard this was the easier way to feed yourself. Also, I figured it would be best if I tried cooking a meal to prove my humanness to the New Earth friends. Today is Thursday, and the party for dinner is Saturday. I decided I would dig into whatever recipe book I could find. I also watched some short videos on grocery stores to prepare myself for this experience. I've learned to stick to the perimeter of the grocery store, as that's where they house the alive food. And I guess the middle aisles are all of the dead food? I don't do much digging here, as I opted for the live food. I mean, I'm not trying to kill my guests. I also watched some videos on dinner parties, cooking, dietary restrictions, and how to make meals exciting for kids. Apparently, some of them have the same troubles I do. Eating is a chore, and what the heck is broccoli doing in my mouth? I have found myself at the grocery store a bit early, as I am worried it will take me longer here than it will to cook the food. I entered what they called Kroger. Odd, but okay. I walked right through the doors and had to maneuver out of the way of a few people grabbing these metallic cages on wheels. My curiosity almost sidetracked me, but I looked ahead and was delighted to see the edible plants staring right back at me. That must be the alive food. Maybe this wasn't going to be so difficult after all. I find most produce is green, and I found the one I'm looking for. Broccoli, they call it here. It resembles a little green tree, a man-made vegetable, funnily enough. What's next, 3D printing meat from animal cells? I found the brightly colored balls called lemons and the purple brain-shaped oval called cabbage. After a while of searching, I finally found the spaghetti squash. This was challenging, as I expected it to look like pasta. I grabbed a couple other things from the dead aisles. I held all of these in my hands until one thing dropped and all the rest went tumbling. A nearby human looked at me with a mix of pity and annoyance. He scoffed and pointed to his metal cage and said, "You know, this is why they invented carts, right?" So I reassembled my ingredients in my arms and returned to the entrance to acquaint myself with the metallic cage on wheels, which I now know is called a cart. That wasn't a part of the informational video. The grocery store is a peculiar place, I tell you. The lighting is offensively bright, the environment is ill-tempered, and it makes my human flesh suit feel cold. I noticed it dropped 260.928 degrees Kelvin the second I entered. People also aren't smiling like they do in other settings. Why am I exchanging this green paper money for this green food when all of these things are naturally found on Earth? Shouldn't I just be able to walk outside and grab them from a plant or a tree? Where are they hiding them? Anyways, I digress. One more thing. Why do the wrinkly people get to use the motorcycle carts? I want one. Time to find the protein. The package in which it comes was quite jarring. Maybe I'm not so in agreement with the kids here after all. I'd rather eat the green stuff that's alive. Kinda odd this stuff isn't in the middle of the store. I mean, it's literally a dead animal. I went with parts of an animal called a chicken, but after it was born and matured, I guess you can get it in egg form, too. Both are quite popular here. After I've gathered my items in this super handy shopping cart, I found what was called the checkout line. I stood in the most popular one with the most people, as I figured this was the safest bet. I waited and waited until it was my turn next. I watched the people in front of me take every item they've recently placed in their cart, out of their cart, and place it onto the conveyor belt. These items are headed to a person who would swipe the item over clear glass with a flashing red light that beeps when activated. I realized I'd been hearing this entire time, but wasn't able to place it. Oh, man, it's my turn. Here we go. Just like the lady did in front of me, I put everything on the belt, dead and alive. "Paper or plastic?" said the swiper. I replied, "No, thank you. There's already enough of that in the food here." As he works on my order, I can't help but think about how each ingredient is like a puzzle piece that I begrudgingly have to fit together. I'll have to make sure it's tasty enough to fool them. Next, I'll have to study processes like steaming the meat and grilling the vegetables. Also, don't get me started on the science of seasonings and the human taste buds. After every item got its beep, I watched as the bags were placed back in my cart. The man who swiped all my items said the total is $81.77. I handed him my $100 bill and began walking out with my metallic cage. Oh, I mean cart. He yelled after me, "Sir, the change," to which I called out like any other human probably would, "I hate change. Keep it."